versus Life Care Centers of America, Inc. Ms. Trent Villam, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kathy Trent Villam, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Life Care of America. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Although this case initially, on first blush, appears to be a standard malpractice action, at its core, it really is a case about the separation of powers. And the question is, does the judiciary, by applying a local rule, or the legislature, by enacting a specific statute, get the final say as to what requirements must be satisfied when a party who wants to revive a case that has been dismissed for lack of prosecution and the statute of limitations has already expired? In the case below, the trial court used its powers to reinstate the case under the local rules, found that good cause had been shown, and reinstated the case. Instead, what the trial court should have done is applied Nebraska's savings statute 25-201-01 and applied that standard to determine whether or not the case should have gone forward. As a result of the way that the court handled the case, it reached a different result than what would have happened had the court applied the savings statute. So by applying a good cause standard under the local rule, the court went ahead and allowed the case to be reinstated, notwithstanding the fact that by the time the court allowed reinstatement, the statute of limitations had expired by 2 years. Had the court gone through and done a savings clause analysis, what the court would have found is that under 25-201-01, that the plaintiffs could not have brought in new action because their case failed as a result of inaction on their part.
Is that a certainty, or is that a conclusion that you have drawn?
That is a certainty, Your Honor, because this court decided in Zitlerkoff that under similar circumstances, where a case is dismissed for lack of prosecution under a progression standard, and the plaintiff tries to initiate a new action under 25-201-01, the court has already held that under those circumstances, the action has failed as a result of inaction on the part of plaintiff, and therefore they cannot seek refuge under 25-201-01.
But this isn't, beg your pardon.
This isn't a new action.
It is not a new action. That is correct, Your Honor.
So how does this savings statute apply at all?
Well, because the savings statute specifically applies if an action is commenced within the time prescribed by the applicable statute of limitations, but the plaintiff in the action, for a reason other than specified in subsection 2, fails. So if the statute specifically applies any time you have a lawsuit that is initiated within the statute of limitations, but fails for a reason other than one set forth in subsection 2.
What do we know about the reasons, the legislature's rationale in enacting 25-201.01? What was the public policy reason behind enacting the statute?
Well, typically, these types of statutes are generally brought in circumstances where a federal action is filed, the federal court loses jurisdiction, and as a result of that, the plaintiff is left without a remedy. By the time the court has gotten to the point of losing jurisdiction, the statute of limitations may have run. In those circumstances where a party has done everything that was required of them under the law, but has lost a cause of action through no fault of their own, the courts have said, okay, under those circumstances, we're going to give you a limited amount of time to come back and refile the action and treat it as if it had been filed within the statute of limitations. So the idea is to give an opportunity for a party who has done everything that's required to do to have an opportunity to continue its case where its case was dismissed through no fault of its own. That is not the circumstances in this case.
As a result of reinstatement, the same action, same pleadings, same docket, same court, same parties, I'm having trouble understanding where you think this action has failed, and moreover, it clearly is not a new action. If anything, it's the same action that's been there. I just don't see how this statute applies to this situation at all.
Well, let me explain, Your Honor. It applies for several reasons. First of all, it applies because it is a continuation of the underlying action. But by the time we got to the point of reinstatement, the party's posture had changed substantially. Plaintiff, after the case had been dismissed, plaintiff went out, retained an expert that they did not have while the case was ongoing, and then came back several months after the case had been dismissed and used that additional expert or new expert testimony as part of the grounds for seeking reinstatement. So by the time
So maybe that's an argument to, it's not in a new action pigeonhole under Chapter 25, but it is under reinstatement under the rule, but going to your second, is it assignment of error, that the court may have abused its discretion by reinstating it. Because all of a sudden there's like a real doctor witness.
Yes, but going back to your question, Judge Castle, the case as it was reinstated was a substantially different case than it was at the time that it was dismissed.
Substantially different because the plaintiff was better prepared?
Right. Basically, the plaintiff used an opportunity and a second bite at the apple to improve its case and undertake efforts that the plaintiff had not undertaken in the 3.5 years since the alleged negligent act and in the year and a half that the case had been on
file. Were there amendments to the complaint that recast the case?
No.
Aren't you asking us to read additional language into 25-201.012? It says a new action may not be commenced. And it seems that that's the subsection you're relying on to saying that this can't be reinstated. But aren't to get there, don't we have to read into that section, a new action may not be commenced and an old action may not be reinstated?
No.
And why not?
Because under the statute, the legislature has specifically given the trial courts authority to dismiss a case for lack of prosecution. And under that statute, the court is to dismiss the case without prejudice. The whole purpose of having a case dismissed without prejudice is so that the party can initiate a new action. So in conjunction with the statute providing for dismissal without prejudice and an action allowing the party to bring a new action, those two statutes work together to basically say, if your case is dismissed without prejudice, under the statute allowing for dismissal for lack of progression, then you can commence a new action.
Can't you also seek to vacate the order of dismissal and reinstate the case?
Well, certainly you can, but then the question becomes, in a case where you have a specific statute, like this statute, which applies where the statute of limitations has applied, or a general statute relating to the vacation of a judgment, which of those two statutes should apply? And this court has said, in a case where you have a specific statute and you have a general statute, the specific statute applies. The challenge with allowing a case to be reinstated and not allowing a new action to be brought is that you basically make the defendant's right to a defense, namely the statute of limitations defense, dependent on which procedural course of action the plaintiff takes. So if the plaintiff takes a course of action by filing for reinstatement because their case was dismissed without prejudice and succeeds, the defendant no longer has a right and a defense that it had but for the reinstatement, which is the statute of limitations defense.
In your answer, you raised statute of limitations as an affirmative defense.
We did.
Did it evaporate by the reinstatement?
No, but through the reinstatement, the effect of that is that it dates back to the original filing, which basically means that the statute of limitations defense goes away. Certainly there's a different position if the case is reinstated and dates back to a time when the case was initially filed within the 2-year limitations period, as opposed to a situation where the suit is refiled 4 years after the case and the statute of limitations defense clearly applies.
If this court were to say we're under the rule and reinstate, where this is a reinstatement rather than a new action and so forth, do you want to speak to why the ruling to reinstate it may have been an abuse?
The ruling to reinstate was an abuse because there had been no progression of the case by the plaintiffs. As the evidence clearly shows, during the year and a half that the case was on file, the plaintiffs had not issued any discovery requests. They had not served any interrogatories. They had not served any production requests. They had not served any requests for admissions. They had not requested a deposition of any defendant. The only discovery that had been done in the case was the interrogatories and the requests for production that were served by the defendant. and the depositions of the plaintiff that were taken. You'll see in the affidavit that counsel provided a number of, well, this email was sent on this and this date, that email was sent on this and this date. All of the actions that were done by plaintiff's counsel in this case were all done in reaction to and in response to something specifically by the defendant. In fact, by the time the case was dismissed, as the evidence shows, plaintiff didn't have even an expert who could have supported the malpractice action at the time that the case was dismissed. The only expert evidence that came into being came in after the case had been dismissed. So what you have are a lot of ministerial tasks that the plaintiff's counsel was doing in response to requests for discovery by the defendant, but no affirmative action on the part of plaintiffs to actually move the case forward.
Was the motion, I'm sorry, did you finish your response?
Yes.
Okay. Was the motion to reinstate filed within 6 months of the order dismissing it?
It was, Your Honor.
It was filed in the same term, wasn't it?
It was.
Before you sit down, I have a final order question.
Yes.
So in Dines versus Essex, this court rejected a blanket rule that says an order reinstating a case after dismissal is always a final appealable order, and instead said there's got to be, it's our regular old final order jurisprudence. So what is the, fit your case into that? Why is this a final order? Why have you appealed from a final order?
There, I don't have the case specifically in front of me, but there is a specific case, Your Honor, that we cite to in the appellate, the jurisdictional statement in our case, where the court has held that in a situation where a court allows for reinstatement after the statute of limitations has applied, that that affects a substantial right, and therefore it falls within appellate jurisdiction.
If we were to find that under 25-201.01, this case could have been refiled, and the statute of limitations wouldn't have had any effect on that, what impact does that have on your substantial right?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I don't know that this court, under this circumstance, based on the record, could make a determination that the statute of limitations defense would not apply.
Under this, as I read the statute under subsection 2, if it's refiled within the window and it wasn't dismissed for one of the prohibited reasons, it can be refiled despite the statute of limitations expiring. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you relying on Jarrett v. Eichler?
That may be the case, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Ms. Reed, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel. I guess as long as it came up, I would like to address the issue of a complete lack of discovery being conducted in this case. As you see from the record, we secured LifeCare's nursing home chart for the client as well as their policies and procedures. There was some informal discovery that was done prior to filing suit, which made it not necessary to subpoena the policies and procedures. We already had it. There was no dispute about that at the trial court level. They didn't deny that they provided us with the records. They provided us with the policies and procedures. And also, Dr. Cho was retained after the notice was sent, but prior to the case being dismissed. And in fact, my client was sent off for some x-ray studies, so I wanted to clarify that as well.
So that's all you did? You got a chart?
No, not at all, Your Honor. We also, they subpoenaed records, and I sent a letter to Mark Novotny, defense counsel, as is common. We do informal discovery. If they ask me for copies of records informally without the need for a document production request, we comply with that, and he did that. I said, I see you've issued a lot of subpoenas. I want copies of the medical records that you've received in response to that. That was a document production request that was done informally. Plaintiff's counsel did initiate and ask for and receive complete copies of all the medical records that were received by defense counsel in response to a subpoena. There were also other delays in this case, Your Honors. This was a medical malpractice case where we had admissions in the chart, and that is part of why the deposition testimony was offered. We already had admissions that staff delayed treatment, they knew about pain complaints, and didn't get this woman to the hospital. We know that that's a violation of not only state regulations, but federal regulations. So when the judge looked at the totality of the circumstances of this specific case, which is a medical malpractice case, all of the tasks that had been done, the parties had been working together, we had actually tried to schedule mediation. We were at the point of potentially resolving this case in September. But due to scheduling conflicts, we had to push back the mediation to accommodate Mark Novotny's schedule, as well as the mediator's schedule. I have no issue with that. And it's common, when we do have a mediation that's going to be set, it's common for us to possibly postpone expert depositions. And that's exactly what the defense attorney did in this case, and said, look, let's see if we can get the case resolved. Let's push off Dr. Waltke's deposition. We also had some unusual delays. You know, in 20 years of practicing, only twice have I had to actually consider subpoenaing my own client's treating physician. Dr. Waltke was the one who performed the surgery, and all of a sudden, for 3 months, he wouldn't talk to us. That is unusual. They couldn't get him to schedule a deposition. I couldn't get him to schedule a deposition. And that created a big red flag for us. We also, in good faith, had a discovery dispute over their subpoenas, which wanted not only my client's medical records and her billing statements, but they wanted to know what was exactly paid by Medicare, what was written off, all of that type of information, which I made a colorable argument because of the new statute that that is not relevant evidence to the case, since the jury only sees what the charges are, not what was written off. So there was a delay while the judge was taking that under advisement. But almost every single month, the parties were working together towards concluding this case. And in fact, by September, well within 18 months, we were at the point where the parties had agreed to mediate the case without a court's order. And I was confident we had a shot. I mean, 92% of the time, mediation is successful. This case was being prosecuted. When you look and compare this with other cases that have come before the Nebraska Court of Appeals and the Nebraska Supreme Court, you have cases where absolutely the plaintiff's counsel is doing no discovery, offers no evidence, sometimes didn't even show up for a hearing,
an abuse of discretion standard that we're reviewing this part of the case on?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the judge used his authority to set aside the order of dismissal, which was stated for lack of prosecution, and so the appropriate standard is abuse of discretion. And I think based on these overwhelming facts, there's two separate affidavits detailing all the activity that was done on this case on both sides of the fence, but also by plaintiff's counsel, and given the specific circumstances in this case, that it was appropriate and not an abuse of discretion for the judge to reinstate the case.
Under the local rules that are applicable here, whose burden is it to submit the progression order? Is it a particular party or is it the parties jointly?
No, Your Honor, I believe that it is stated in there that the notice is issued to both parties, and both parties are required to submit a proposed scheduling order. This is not something that is exclusively the burden of the plaintiff, and that is important. As much as they try to beat up the plaintiff for not filing a jointly signed proposed scheduling order within the 30-day deadline, there is absolutely not one shred of evidence that a defense attorney didn't also get that notice and defense attorney also did not meet that deadline and offers no excuse and no explanation whatsoever for not meeting that deadline. The only argument that was made was, well, gee whiz, Your Honor, it's not in our interest to comply with that local rule because why would we ever want the case to stay reinstated or not get kicked out. That's not in my client's best interest. But as an officer of a court, don't we on both sides of the fence have to follow the rules equally? And certainly, the exact rule is directed at both parties and specifically uses the language each party, not just plaintiff.
Do you want to address the proposed tension between the rule and the statute?
I don't see any tension between the rule and the statute. I still don't see the logic of the argument. The appellants want to strike down the local rule, but there's no argument. It was the local rule that was the basis for dismissing the case. So if the local rule is truly invalid, that case should have never been dismissed. But I submit to you, Your Honors, I don't think that there is any contradiction between the local rule or the state statute or the inherent authority of our district courts to vacate their orders within term and the savings statute. I think the savings statute exists concurrently with that. If a case truly fails, and maybe the operative term there is fail, if it fails, if a case is dismissed, a party petitions to have it reinstated and the court fails to reinstate it, but they're given a hearing, an opportunity to show evidence, the court says no, just like in Zitterkopf, the court says no, you didn't do anything. I'm not going to reinstate it. Now I think you have a situation where it fails and you might have an option to trigger the savings clause.
In Zitterkopf, there was a show cause hearing, wasn't there?
There was. It was, yes.
Rather than an administrative dismissal.
Correct. And I think that the difference could be more important. When this case was dismissed on an administrative dismissal, there was no hearing or opportunity to get at the merits of whether truly this order, which was based on a lack of prosecution, as stated in the order itself, whether it was truly based on a lack of prosecution or whether this was a case that was being prosecuted and should be justly reinstated. But so I don't see any attention. And I think maybe the key term there is fails. There is a way to read these statutes and the local rule all consistently, and I think we have principles of statutory construction that would favor how can we read these consistently. But also to read them any other way becomes nonsensical. We have a local rule, and I don't know if they're trying to say, well, sever the second part of the local rule. We want you to keep the part that kicked the case out, but we don't want you to keep the part that let the court reinstate it. If the local rule was invalid, then the case should have never been dismissed. But I think that this court ought to preserve the district court's inherent power and statutory right to vacate its orders within terms. If there are errors that are made, if there are things that need to be reconsidered, the district courts need to have that opportunity. People need to have the option to bring matters to the court to reconsider to see if the case can be reinstated. And only then, if a case fails, would a litigant possibly be able to turn to the savings clause. The last thing I want to say is there's a lot of counsel in the brief talked about the fact that, you know, there's all this time delays and they want to date it back to the actual date that the incident occurred. She says, you know, they waited almost 2 years to file suit. I would argue this is really reaching and just plain not appropriate. My client was in an emergency room the day after this happened, recovering from surgery. She cannot be expected to hire a lawyer that same day. She cannot be expected to hire medical experts that same day. In most cases, people following surgery don't even know what their outcome will be. It wasn't apparent that this woman had permanent nerve damage until some time later. A litigant, and it, you know, as a lawyer, you don't always get people who come to you promptly after the incident occurs. Sometimes we don't get cases until 1 or 2 weeks before the statute of limitations. But that fact alone is not in any way that it's not appropriate to say that the client is dilatory or that the plaintiff should be punished, A, for not bringing suit within a week of the statute of limitations. What matters is the time frame after that. And after that, there was something going on in this case to actively move it forward and almost towards mediation the entire time. We would urge this court to affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No.
There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day...